many of you ever heard somebody say, or perhaps you have said it yourself, I wish that I have never been born? You know, usually it's somebody caught in the midst of some teenage angst. Maybe they're throwing something against the wall or something, but then they scream out, I just wish I had never been born. And if you think about it, it's a pretty adult thought. You know, I wish that I had never been born. I wish that I had never made an impact on anybody. I wish that everything that I have ever done or said is gone, because everybody would be better off if I wasn't here. I wish I had never been born. I think I remember the first time this happened to me, I was like 6 years old. So it's an adult thought, but oftentimes kids have it, right? And I remember it was in the yellow house. So we moved out of the yellow house when I was like 7 years old. So I had to be less than that. And I had this thought, I wish I had never been born. And I don't remember what happened in my life that got me to that point, but I remember trying to destroy every single one of my brother's possessions in our room, and mine as well, screaming at the top of my lungs, I wish that I had never been born. Why would somebody ever wish that? And I think the answer is because life is kind of hard, isn't it? Life is kind of hard, and sometimes it's not overly fair either. I think sometimes we kind of have this assumption that the world should be easy and the world should be fair. And when we run across this idea that it's not, it can kind of create a crisis. And sometimes we think that. We think, man, life would be better if I had never been born. And I don't think the Bible shies away from this idea. The Bible doesn't say everything is going to be perfect. It doesn't even say that when you become a Christian and you follow Jesus, then everything in your life is going to work out just right as well. We still live in a world that is broken by sin and it is cursed. And so we're going to bump into that every once in a while. I mean, prayer request time is a time that we bump against that quite a bit, right? You know, we kind of wake up from the fact that, you know, things might be going well for me personally, but not everybody has a rosy picture going on right now. And so sometimes we bump into the brokenness of life. And so how are we supposed to deal with this? And so the author of Ecclesiastes, the teacher, he doesn't shy away from this idea either. In fact, today we're going to see he kind of leans into it. Yes, this world's broken. Yes, it seems meaningless. But God has given us some strategies that we can use to help us to get through it. Okay, the first and the most important one, and I don't want to miss that as we kind of look at what the teacher says, is that we have God, the God of the universe, that we can talk to and rely on and depend on. That he is there for us. We can always turn to him. You know, we learn from the Bible that he sticks closer than a brother. Okay, Jesus sticks closer than a brother. He's always there for us when we need him. But here we see another God-given strategy on how to survive this broken world is good, godly friends and family. So friends and family are a God-given gift to you that he wants you to use to help survive the brokenness of this world. And what's interesting to me is that this happened even before the fall that God instituted friendship, partnership. You know, we think of the main relationship, the marriage relationship, but really partnership had its birth before the fall as well. So you remember day one of creation. What does God say at the end of the day? It's good. Day two, end of the day, what does God say? It's good. Day three, day four, day five. What does he say at the end of day six? It's very good. Okay, now, earlier on in day six, God said something that's kind of out of the pattern. God said, this is not good. And so out of all of his creation on day six, what did he say was not good? And so God created the heavens and the earth. God created the animal kingdom and the birds of the air and everything that you can see and dry ground and water and all this stuff. What didn't he create yet? He hadn't created woman. So he created man, and he looked at man and he said, it is not good for man to be alone. Okay, now wait a second. It's not good for man to be alone. Okay, didn't he have God? Wasn't God there with him and for him? Didn't he have a relationship with him? Wasn't that good? Well, yeah, that was good. But it wasn't good for man to be alone because he didn't have somebody that corresponded to him. That's what God says. He has no one that corresponds to him. The animals, they don't correspond to him. As much as the relationship between God and mankind is a great relationship, there's still not a correspondence there. And so God says, I want to create somebody that corresponds to him. So God created woman. And so now we have a partnership. And then at the end of that, God says, now this is very good. And so God created us to be in community with people who correspond to us. He created us to be in community with him too. But he also created us to be in partnership with people who correspond to us. And this, of course, includes wife, husband. But it also includes parents and siblings and children and close friends. You know, all of these people can come into our life and give us the strength that we need to make this world a little bit more bearable. Family and friends are God-given, and they're a way that God has put into our life that we can kind of survive when things get tough. So here's the question. Do you have any friends? And if you do, how many friends do you have? Okay, so I was thinking about this question in my own head, and so I thought, well, of course, the best place to go to see my measure of friendship is my Facebook page, right? So here's my Facebook page, all right? And you can see friends, if you can see it, it's a little light there, but right next to it, 554 friends. Now, I've gotten two more friends this week since I posted this, and now I've got 556? Yes! I got 556 friends. Now, I know that I got a few close friends who are, you know, aren't on Facebook by principle, and so that might number, it might go up to 580. I got 580 friends, right? No, of course not, right? We know that Facebook friends do not equal real friendships. Okay, for you younger people who don't do Facebook, Instagram, Snapchat, whatever you want to call it. All right? This does not equal real friendships. Now, maybe you're more astute than that, and you know Facebook friends don't equal real friends. But you think, well, the people who post on my stuff, so I put my little post out there online, and somebody comments on it or somebody likes it. Now, those are my real friends. Okay, so if you don't post on my stuff, you're not my real friend. But if you post on my stuff, then you're my real friend. So that guy that you knew 22 years ago, haven't seen him since then, but he said happy birthday to you on your birthday, is he your real friend? You know, he might have got a little comment on his phone that says, hey, today is Aaron Pierce's birthday. Wish him a happy birthday. And all he had to do was click one button. And he said, happy. That guy's my real friend? You know, probably not. You know, digital friendships are not necessarily real friendships. And so I think social media is kind of changing how friendship works, and we don't even know what it's doing to us yet. And I think that some of the things that it might be doing is changing for the worse, you know, our definition and expectations of friendship. Okay, there's this scholar by the name of Robin Dunbar. He's from Oxford University, and he's done lots. He's spent his whole life studying the idea of friendship. And there's if you've ever researched friendship, you've probably come across Dunbar's number. Most of you probably haven't researched friendship, and that's okay. But here are Dunbar's numbers, and I just want to talk about a few of them that are important for what we're talking about here today. The first one is this 1,500 number. So this is the amount of people that a human being is capable of recognizing on sight. Okay, so you can only recognize 1,500 people on site. That's all your brain has room for. Okay, so I was looking up a friend of mine the other day, and I saw on his Facebook page that he has 4,000 friends. I was like, whoa, this dude's popular. My own dad, I think, has close to 1,500 friends. But I think this is true. This is what he's found, that you know, your Facebook counter might say that you have 4,000 friends, but you can only even recognize 1,500 people on the street. It's all your brain can handle. Okay, here's Dunbar's number. It's the middle one, number 150. 150 is as many friendships as you can handle. That's it. You can only handle 150 friendships. Now, you might think that sounds like a lot. At first blush, that's not a lot. You know, we've got our church family list. If everybody from our church family list showed up, that'd be about 150 people. We're a small church. Okay, if everybody that just regularly comes all of a sudden showed up on one Sunday, we'd have about 120 people. So 150 people is not all that much, but that's all you really can handle. Now, Dunbar has figured out that this is actually a range. Okay, so 200 people for the most social of us, you can handle 200 friends. For the least social among us, you can only handle about 100 friends. Okay, so it's actually, Dunbar's number is actually range. So if you think you got 4,000 friends because Facebook tells you, you know, those aren't even casual friends. Those are barely even acquaintances. Many of them are not. You just can't handle that. All right, the next step down is 50, actually, which he doesn't have up here. So I think it might be the 35 number. But you can only have 35 close friends. These are people that you might invite to your house for a dinner party. These are people that you don't really share the intimate details of your life, but they know a little bit about you and your situation. Okay, the next group down is 15. Okay, so this is the second to last number there. 15, you can have 15 friends that you confide in. A lot of the details that are going on in your life. And these are the people that if you're stranded on the side of the road at 2 in the morning, you feel comfortable enough to call them. And that they're the kinds of people that are going to drop everything and say, I know I'm asleep, but I'm going to come get you wherever you are. So the normal person can handle about 15 of those kind of friends. And then the 5, these are the core people. These are the people who know you in and out. These are the people that are going to be there for you no matter what happens. They're going to be the ones that help you in a lurch. You know, maybe we could call them best friends. And so you can only handle at most, Dunbar says, 5 best friends. So they've done some more research on social media too, and they found that the median number of Facebook friends that somebody has is 300. And if you dig a little further, they'll say that of those 300, they only really know 75 of them. Okay, the other 225 are, you know, acquaintances at best. So who are your friends? Who are your friends? Who can you count on in a lurch? When you bump up against the brokenness of the world, who is going to be there for you? You know, someone said that in order to have lived a successful life, you need to have enough good friends that to be your pallbearers at your funeral. 6, right? 6. Okay, and so we're not suggesting when we talk about friendships that you need to be friends with the world, because it's just impossible to be friends with everybody. But you need to have some close friends in your life so that when you bump up against the brokenness of the world, and when you get in trouble, there's somebody that sticks by you. And that's actually a way to figure out who your close friends really are. I don't suggest you do this. Don't say, Aaron told me to go do this today. But go get in trouble. Go do something really stupid. And then you're going to know who your friends are. Because, you know, somebody that is not really your friend, you know, once you become a liability to their reputation, you're gone. Okay, but a real friend, even when you mess up, is going to be there to try to help keep you on the right track, help push you in the right direction. And so God has given us friends and family in our life to be there for us through adversity. You know, Proverbs 17:17 says this, you know, a friend loves at all times, and a brother is born for adversity. So think about that last statement. A brother is born for adversity. That means that God is saying there's going to be adversity in your life, but that God has placed people in your life that can be there for you. And so this is the same guy, right? If we believe Solomon wrote Ecclesiastes, then this is the same guy that said this that's going to say what we're looking at here today. And that is that a friend is there for you when you need them the most, and it is a God-given gift to us. So God created us to be in community. You know, God created us to have relationships with other people and other believers. The Christian life was never meant to be lived alone. And sometimes I think in America, we've so personalized it. You know, we even say it that way, my personal walk with Jesus, which you should have a personal walk with Jesus, of course. But we've almost made it an individual thing, like the Christian life can be lived alone. And that's why you get a lot of people in our culture today, well, I don't go to church. I don't need to go to church. You know, I'll just watch Joel Osteen on the television or whatever, and, you know, that's good enough for me. No, it's not. Because God created us to live the Christian life in community, in Christian community. Yet, as Americans, we tend to personalize it, you know, because we value that. We value mobility, you know, probably more than any other culture on the planet. We value the ability to say, I don't want to live in Ohio anymore. I don't want to live in Indiana anymore. I'm going to move to Arizona and start over. You know, we value that. That we value convenience. We want things to be easy for us, and oftentimes long-term friendships are not that convenient. You know, we value privacy. Stay out of my life. Okay, I'll have you there when I'm comfortable with having you there, but for the most part, leave me alone. We value privacy as a culture. We value individualism and independence. You know, we think when we get in trouble, our first thought isn't, how can somebody else help me get through this? Our first thought is, I need to do this alone. I don't want to be a burden on anybody else. And so we have this very big individualistic streak in our society, and that can spill over into our Christian life as well. You know, people have been asking me all month, some form of this. You know, because Jackson, this is his first real experience in America when he came up here. And so people have been asking me some form of this. Did he want to go home? Okay, did he want to go home or did he want to stay here in America? And I think the idea behind it is once Jackson, somebody like Jackson, who comes from a third world country, once he's experienced the affluence of America, can he go back and enjoy his time in Haiti? You know, can he go back? And my answer has been every time, Of course he can. They don't like it here. And you're like, well, how in the world can they not like it here? We got McDonald's, Walmart, Amazon. These are great things. They don't like it. And the biggest reason they don't like it is because the way we do life is different than the way they do life. And they don't like that. They don't like how you'll hear this all the time. They'll say, well, you guys just go home at night and you shut your door and you lock everybody out and you really don't have any community. And they can't live that way down there. I mean, they're just, everybody's there all the time. You know, there's not really very much privacy. You know, in this tiny little house, there can be four or five different families that all live together. And so they're always in community and they cherish that. And so when they get up here, they're like, I don't understand how you guys live. I don't understand how you guys cut yourself off from everybody else. So they're willing to go back to their struggle to survive and their meal one day, maybe every other day, they get a meal. They're willing to go back to that because they value the community. And so we've kind of tried to kill that as much as we can. You know, it used to be in history, the community was the building block of society. In the Western world over the past 500 years, we've changed that to the individual as being the building block of society. And it's no wonder that many of us suffer from anxiety and depression because we've cut off one of God's main lifelines to help us by living in a dark world, a broken world. You know, God has given us real friendships and real community, Christian community, to help us through these things. So there's a historian that pointed out, really, that the beginning of the demise in the West, you know, of community was actually the invention of the printing press. So books were what began to pull us away from each other. Not necessarily TV, some people blame TV, but it was actually books. You know, Chuck Swindoll, and he was preaching a sermon on something similar, and he said this, I suppose this is another way of saying that most of us would rather curl up alone with a good book than curl up with another person. And so we've been aiming at this dream of privacy. We've been aiming at it for 500 years, and I think we've reached it. In the past 50 years, we have become a very isolated and lonely culture. And so as Americans, we're often ill-equipped to handle difficulty. And you know, that's another thing you realize when you go to a third world country is that they deal with tragedy a lot different than we do. We're ill-equipped for it because we really don't have these close friendships and ties to help us to get through things when it gets tough. And we in the rural area, we have it a little bit better than those in the suburban and urban areas, especially the suburban area. Suburban area has really isolated themselves because they've isolated themselves from family. You know, in the rural areas, we have big families that tend to stick together, and we were able to get a lot of support from that. All right, so what does the teacher have to say here about friendship? Okay, and so again, we've got these great verses on friendship, and maybe some of you have them up on your wall somewhere on a sign, or maybe you've got them scrawled somewhere because these are very famous words, probably some of the most famous words from the book of Ecclesiastes. But sometimes we just cherry pick these four verses on friendship and we kind of rip them out of the context here. The context, if you read it, which we just did, is kind of a dismal context. It's about the harsh reality of the world. And so let's look at verses 1 through 3 here of chapter 4. So again, I considered all the oppression that continually occurs on earth, and this is what I saw. The oppressed were in tears, but no one was there to comfort them. No one delivers them from the power of their oppressors. And so I considered those who are dead and gone more fortunate than those who are still alive. But better than both is the one who has not yet been born and has not seen the evil things that are done on the earth. Okay, so he starts out just by kind of saying a fact here, and that is that the world is a pretty harsh place. And so it talks a lot about the wonders of friendship, but against this background that the world can be pretty hard to live in. And so he's looking at his surroundings and he's saying this is kind of tough. You know, the poor, they're oppressed and nobody's able to stand up for them. You know, he sees the grief and the tears of those who have experienced injustice. And he says that there is no one to give them comfort. He actually says that twice. If you look at this closely, he says two times there is no one to give them comfort. So the boss man could walk all over them and there's nothing they could do about it. The government could come and take what they wanted and there's nothing that they could do about it. And so it's a harsh wake-up call when people realize that this world isn't all that fair. You know, probably your kids have said this at one point or another. If you are a teenager or a kid, you've probably said it yourself. You know, the world's not fair. That's not fair. Life's not fair, right? That's what we tell them. Okay. But usually this happens when they bump up into something in their world where they think that they deserve something and they don't get it. And that's when you begin to realize, oh yeah, this world isn't very fair. Well, why did they get ice cream and I didn't? That's not fair. I hear that all the time. I'll take one of the kids out shopping or something and I'll give them an ice cream when I get home, and that's the first thing I hear. That's not fair. Why did they get that and I didn't get that? And it's not just kids, is it? It's us too. You know, we go to work at a job and, you know, we've been there for 10 years, and then this other guy comes and he's been there 2 years and he's promoted over top of you. That's not fair. I've been here this long and I'm a better employee than they are. It's just because he knows so-and-so's brother. That's why he got the promotion. And so then you begin to realize again, life's not fair. Okay, and so we bump up into that all the time because guess what? Life isn't fair. And if we expect fairness, we're going to be consistently disappointed because the world is not fair. And so the teacher sees this. He sees that life isn't fair. He sees that life is broken. And he says, man, wouldn't it be better just to not have ever lived? If I just never been born and never seen the evil and the injustice of the world, I think I'd be better off. And I think people who are never born, they must be better off because they've never bumped into the brokenness of this world. And so he's trying to tell us that the world can be a very harsh place. You know, I just got finished reading a book on the Underground Railroad, and it's aptly titled. It's called The Underground Railroad. Okay, and it's a Pulitzer Prize winner from last year, and I was just saying, I need to read a book, and Shannon just shoved it in my face. Read this book. So I was like, okay, I guess I'll read this book. And, we learn about American slavery from the time that we're little, but we kind of in school get a very sanitized version of it, and this book was trying to do the opposite, trying to give us a very realistic picture of what life would have been like as an African slave in America. And it's absolutely horrific. I mean, it's on par, you know, with what Hitler did to the Nazis. I mean, to treat other human beings as if they are not really human beings, they're just cattle or dogs. I mean, it's horrible. And I found myself, the book is, I don't suggest you read it because it's very graphic. But, you know, I found myself when I go to bed at night when I was reading this book and I would close my eyes, these images would be burned into the back of my eyelid. And I would just see these things and it would just make me angry that these are the types of things that happened right on our own soil. And there were Americans that were okay with it. How can that be? And it's because this world is broken. God knows that. And if we open our eyes, of course, we know that too. And God says there's no one to give comfort. And so how do we find comfort in a broken world? Well, you know, I think there are two God-given strategies. There, first of all, of course, is that we go to God. God is always there, and we'll talk more about that here in a minute. But second, God has also given us good Christian friends and family, solid friends that we can face life with if we take advantage of it. You guys probably remember the story. We watch it every Christmas. It's a Wonderful Life. Good old George Bailey, right? Okay, what happened to George Bailey? If you remember in the movie, you know, he running his own savings and loan company, and then one of his co-workers loses $8,000. Actually, it gets stolen. And so the first part of the movie is them trying to track down this $8,000, and they can't. Now what are we going to do? We don't have cash flow to make this thing run. So the first thing that George does is he says, well, I know Mr. Potter. Mr. Potter's a wealthy person. You know, he's not going to give me the money, but maybe he'll loan me the money. And so he goes to Mr. Potter and tries to get the money, but of course Mr. Potter says no. Now what is he going to do? His business is going under. There's no safety net. What is he going to do? And so there's this scene where he's standing there on the bridge contemplating his own suicide because he knows he's got an insurance policy. And if I die, my family will get the insurance, and then they'll be able to get out of the hole that I've dug. And so George is saying to himself, I'm worth more dead than alive. And this is where Clarence, his guardian angel, shows up. And he shows him an alternate reality. This is what reality would have been like if you'd never been born. So we might, you know, throw something at the wall and say, I wish I'd never been born. Well, George does that. Clarence comes and says, this is what it would have been like if you had never been born. And he's able to see the impact that his life has had on other people and how he has made other people's lives better and more endurable. And so at the end of that, George begs to be given another chance. Let me have another chance. And so we see the last scene of the movie is a very powerful scene, and all these people that have been affected by George Bailey, they come and they give. Once they know the need, they didn't know the need, right? Because George was just independent. I'm going to solve this on my own. But once the community knew the need, they were right there by his side. And then at the end, his brother lifts a glass to him, and he says, to the richest man in town. Now, why is George the richest man in town? Because right behind him is this pile of money now that he can use to pay off his debt. No, he's the richest man in town because of all the people he's affected in life, because of all the friends that he has that came alongside of him. And if we didn't get it yet, we get this last note at the end of the movie. Clarence writes George a note, and it says, "Remember, no man is a failure who has friends." That's the point of the movie, It's a Wonderful Life. I mean, we watch it at Christmas time, but it's a really universal message. No man is a failure who has friends, because we have someone to face life with, this broken world with. All right, so life's broken. Okay, now where the teacher goes is he says, now there are a couple of ways that people try to deal with this that are very unhealthy, that are not really going to solve the problem. And I'm not going to read them again. But the first one comes from verses 4 through 8. And it says that all the wealth in the world isn't going to help you through the brokenness of it. Okay? Wealth alone won't help you through it. And so the teacher is trying to describe some strategies. The first person, actually, he talks about is the lazy person. The person who just kind of folds his arms, and he's not going to do anything at all. He's seen the brokenness of life, and so he's opted out. I don't want to do this life thing anymore. And he says, no, that's not going to work. This man's laziness is going to ruin him. So he says opting out of life isn't the answer. But then he says, this is his real point, wealth isn't the answer either. You can work and you can work and you can make yourself great, but you're going to find that all of it's like chasing the wind. It's meaningless. It's havel. So the second man, he works hard and there's no end to his toil, yet his eyes are never satisfied with his wealth. And so at the end of the day, he asks himself a good question. What have I been working for? I've been working all these hours, I've been working all these years, and I've been building up this big bank account. And what am I going to do? Use it on? It's just me. I don't have anybody to share it with. And he says this is havel, that we work hard, we make all this money, but we're alone at the end of the day and we have no one to share it with. All the wealth in the world is meaningless if you don't have friends and family to share it with. And so Solomon's kind of describing the rat race for us, you know, 3,000 years before we've come to know it. You know, there's a story about Abraham Lincoln, and he's walking down the road with his two sons and they're fighting, okay, like brothers and sisters do, right? And this guy comes along behind him and he says, "Why are your sons fighting?" And Abraham Lincoln says, "Well, same thing's wrong with them as wrong with everybody. I got three walnuts and both of them want two." That's what he says. Got three walnuts and both of them want two. They're not satisfied with one, they want two. They want more than the other one has. And that is what's wrong with the world. Sin is what's wrong with the world. Envy, greed, discontentment, but that's the world that we live in. In a world that no matter how much we have, we are usually still discontent. Even if we have one, we want two. If we have two, we want three. Because we think that somehow if I have more, it's going to bring happiness. It's going to bring meaning into my life. It's going to help me cope with the world. But at the end of the day, it really doesn't. You know, someone said this, you know, even if you win the rat race, at the end of the day, aren't you still a rat? And it's a good point. And so God is always warning us of the dangers of wealth throughout the Bible. And here he does the same thing, is that you might strive with two hands. You might work 80, 90 hours a week thinking that somehow, you know, that it's going to bring satisfaction and meaning into your life. But at the end of the day, you're going to see that it's havel. Only a relationship with God and only a relationship with good, godly friends is what's going to matter. You know, Paul says it this way, godliness with contentment is great gain. That's where the gain is in godliness with contentment. In chapter 5, which we're not going to study, but the teacher says this, whoever loves money never has money enough, and whoever loves wealth never satisfied with his income. And so he's just saying, you know, somebody makes $50,000, and they're thinking, if I just made 60, and someone's making 60, if I just made 70, then I'd be able to deal with this broken world. And it's always just a little bit more, always just a little bit more. When in reality, they should turn around and see what God has blessed them with. So, all the money in the world isn't going to fix this broken world. It's not going to help us to endure it. In 1934, there was a man named Percy Shore, and he invented those little cat eye reflectors that are on the side of the road, like the yellow ones in the middle and the white ones on the side. Guy made so much money, he didn't know what to do with it. He retired, he was like age 34, never worked again, and didn't really have any friends or family. And so he just filled his house with every gadget that was available in the 1930s. And they said that he was so aimless, he would just walk around town and just stand places and just stare at the sky. Because he just had nothing to do. He had nothing to spend his money on. You know, what good is it if you've built all this empire up, but you have nobody to share it with? The teacher says that's havel. A man's life does not consist in the abundance of their possessions. You can have a lot of wealth and this world still cripple you. And so I get the picture in my mind of good old Scrooge McDuck here, Ebenezer Scrooge. And if you remember, talking a lot about Christmas movies today, I guess. But if you remember A Christmas Carol, you know, if you watch The Ghost of Christmas Past, we see that Scrooge had opportunity after opportunity to have friends and family. It wasn't like nobody liked the guy. You know, when he was younger, people really wanted to be part of his life, but he kept pushing them off. I don't want this. I don't want this. I want to follow my career. I want to make more money. And so at the end of the day, what does he have? He has money to keep him company. That's it. He has nobody to share it with. And so that makes the ending of the book or the movie so much greater when he does realize that friends and family are what it's all about. That's what makes life worth living. All right, so money isn't going to help you to solve the problems of this world. And neither is power. Okay, and we can read about this in verses 13 through 16. So this comes after the verses on friendship. But power as well. People think if I just had more power, then I would be able to deal with the harshness of life. I can just say, you're out of my life, get out of here. Or you have the power to fix it. He says this too is havel, because you know you're going to grow old and then some fresh-faced person is going to replace you and your power is going to be gone. You know, if you think that you once you have it all, that all your problems are going to go away, then you're wrong. So there's a, you know, as you probably remember Margaret Thatcher. If you don't, you know, she lived and ruled in Britain in the 80s. And her and Ronald Reagan together, they helped orchestrate the downfall of the USSR. And they lifted the Iron Curtain, so all those Eastern European countries were free. And, of course, we're still feeling the effects of what the USSR did to those countries even today. If you look at the unemployment rate in West Germany, it's almost what ours is. If you look at the unemployment rate in East Germany, it's what ours was during the Great Depression. They're still recovering from what happened to them. And Margaret Thatcher and Ronald Reagan were two great leaders that were able to bring this down. And but what happened to Margaret Thatcher in 1990 is very interesting. So you got this hugely important woman in history. She did these great things, but in 1990, she got kicked out of her job. And nobody wanted to have her. Her approval rating was through the floor. So what happened? What happened from this woman doing these incredible things to being kicked out of office? Well, she came up with a new platform, and the people in Britain did not like it one bit. And so they decided that they were going to let her go. And so there's this famous scene as she's leaving 10 Downing Street, and she has tears in her eyes, and you can just see the expression on her face. What did I do? You know, how could this possibly happen? I had all this power, and now I have none. But that's often what happens, is that people who get to the top of the power game and they think that I'm going to be able to orchestrate things for my benefit now, you know, pretty soon they find themselves without any power at all. Power is not going to solve it either. In the Pickwick Papers, Mr. Pickwick sings this, "If I ruled the world, every day would be the first day of spring." Sounds nice. Sounds like if you just had some power, you could make it work, but the reality of life is quite different. You know, oftentimes we think that. They think that, you know, the person that's the CEO or the person that's the managing partner or the president of the United States or whoever they might be, we think, man, their life has got to be so great because they have so much power. And it's just not true. The world of power is a very lonely world. Power isn't going to help you when it comes across the brokenness of the world either. You can only cope with it with the help of God and with others by your side. You know, throughout Scripture, we're told that Jesus is the perfect friend, that he sticks closer than a brother. Now, Jesus said this. He says, "Come unto me, all you are weary and heavy burdened, and I will give you rest. If you're thirsty, come to me and drink. Come and feed upon me." And so Jesus is saying, I'm there for you. I'm the rock that's going to help you to get through these things. And I've given you good, godly friends to help you get through it as well. So wealth isn't going to help us to deal with a harsh world. Power isn't going to help us to deal with a harsh world. So what is? And this is where we get to this next God-given strategy. Only bonded friends and family will help you through it. Only bonded friends and family will help you through it. So let's look at verse 9 through 12, these verses on friendship. You know, two people are better than one because they can reap more benefit from their labor. For if they fall, one will help his companion up. But pity the person who falls down and has no one to help him up. Furthermore, if two lie down together, they can keep each other warm. But how can one person himself keep warm? Or how can one keep warm by himself? So bonded friends and family are there to help us through it. And we see four things that they provide for us. The first is profit. He says, two are better than one. because they have a better return on their labor. You know, working side by side with someone makes all the difference. It helps the day go faster. It helps the day to be more enjoyable. You know, twice a year, I spend a half a day cleaning out the garage and the shed. And I usually don't ask for help. I just go do it. And when I'm doing it by myself, it's not really all that much fun. Okay? And it's hard work. You know, but every once in a while, Caleb will see that I'm working out there, or Shannon will see that I'm working out there, and they'll come and they'll start pulling stuff out and start sweeping things and start helping me get things down from the loft. And it's amazing how much easier the work is when someone comes alongside of you and begins to help. The same amount of work, really, but it just feels so much lighter because someone is there sharing that burden with you. And that's what the teacher is telling us, is that we have more return on our labor. It puts a little bit of pep in your step. It helps you to face reality when you have someone by your side. The second thing is we get help or aid. If one person falls down, the other person can help them up. You know, pity the person who falls down and nobody's there to help them up. That's not very good. You know, this time of year you see a lot of geese flying, a lot of those Canadian geese. You know, I can't remember where Caleb and I were, but just a couple of days ago he pointed this out, that there was this huge V formation of geese. And I looked out the window and there they were, just this huge formation. And if you pay attention, they actually swim in a V formation as well. And so why a V? Why does that happen? Well, it's because the way that they fly, it gives a lift, right? There's this lift right behind them. Okay, and so if the other goose can get into that little pocket of lift there, it's a lot easier for them to fly. In fact, they can fly 72% farther if they're flying in a V formation than they could otherwise. And if that goose falls down out of that position, he's going to notice it really quick. That drag is going to go right against him. And so they fly together. And it's the same thing with us. If we try to live our lives out of formation, it's going to be difficult. We need to surround ourselves with good, godly friends and take advantage of the lift that they give to us. And so how many of us are living outside the formation? How many of us are trying to face this broken world alone? God has made us for community so that we can draw strength from each other. That's one of the great things about church family. Church family, that's one of the things we should be about, is giving each other lift and comfort and encouragement and pointing each other in the right direction. The third thing is comfort. You know, a friend will give you comfort. He says, when two lie down together, they will keep warm. And so the picture is of two travelers going on the road, and, you know, in the desert, it's hot during the day, but at night it's really cold. And he says, two can huddle up together and they can give each other warmth. So every once in a while, I watch a show called Running Wild with Bear Grylls. Maybe you've seen a Bear Grylls show before, but he's like a survivalist guy. Anyway, this one, he takes a celebrity out into the wilderness for 2 days and one night. And sometimes they go to places where it's pretty cold at night. And so Bear Grylls was like, I hope you like me, because we're going to get all up and close and comfortable tonight. And sure enough, when the lights go out, Bear's arms go around this celebrity, and you can see in their eyes, his big eyes, like, this is a little bit more Bear Grylls than I ever wanted. Okay, but in the morning, they inevitably say the same thing. Oh, man, I'm so glad that Bear was there, because I would have been freezing otherwise. Okay, two can draw warmth from each other, comfort from each other. Even when the world is hard, we can draw strength from other people because they can encourage us when life gets tough. The fourth thing he says is that friends give us protection. One person can be overpowered. Two people, they're a little stronger. It's a bond that's not quite as easily broken. And he compares it to a rope. He says a two-strand rope, you know, not very strong. Three-strand rope, stronger. Four-strand rope, even stronger. You know, there's a military strategy when this was written. You know, when you were, especially when you're in hand-to-hand combat, you would have a partner, and you would put your back up against your partner's back. Because, you know, you have a pretty big blind spot when you're fighting. You can't see what's going on behind you. You don't have eyes in the back of your head. But if you have a friend that's on the other side of you with his back to you as well, then you're protected. And that's exactly what we see here with friendships. Friendships can be there to help us, to protect us when life, you know, chews us up and spits us out. So how do we forge these kind of bonds in our life? How do we get these kind of friendships? And I think there are three things that we need to try to do if we want to have good, strong Christian friendships that are going to help us when times get tough. The first one, and this is probably the most unpopular one, you're going to have to take time. Okay, friendships take time. You know, I read that a normal conversation, the first 7 minutes of it are small talk. It's not until minute eight that you begin to really get into some things that matter. And I did this right before the family reunion. And so I just thought, well, I'll just pay attention. I'll see if this is true. And as I watched conversations unfold that day, I saw that this is very much true. 7 minutes of small talk, and then you start talking about, you know, something that really gets you going, or something passionate, or something that's going on in your life, something a little bit deeper. And so it's just true that friendships are going to take time. You can't just see somebody for 5 minutes a week and think that that friendship is going to be deep. It's just not. You're going to have to say, I want to be intentional, I'm going to take my time, and I'm going to be with this person. And so find somebody who you like, hopefully, somebody who likes to do some of the same things that you do, and do them together. Oh, I like to ski. So do I. Go ski together. You know, I like to sew. Me too. Go sew together. I like to golf. Me too. Go golf together. Okay, it's going to take some time, though. The second is that we need to be intentional. If we want strong friendships, we have to be intentional about it. We can't just say, yeah, how about we go golf sometime? Sounds good. And then you walk away. Okay, you're never going to go golf. Okay, say, hey, on the 4th, 8 o'clock tea time, you ready? Give them a time. Give them a day. Be intentional about it, and so that you can build those friendships. You know, as I was doing the sermon, I couldn't help but think about my groomsmen. Okay, so just for a second, think about your bridesmaids or your groomsmen. How many of those do you still have a relationship with today? So I was thinking about that. I think I had 7 groomsmen, 2 ushers, and 2 of them are named Sean. They're my brother-in-laws, so I still have relationships with them, very good relationships. But the others? You know, my best man at my wedding, he wrote me on Facebook, I think, 4 or 5 months ago. And he just said, Aaron, I really miss you. And he says, next time you get to Indianapolis, we have to get together. So next time you go to Indianapolis, make sure you tell me that you're going to be there so that we can get together. You know, when we first got married and started going our separate ways, for a while I was pretty intentional about giving him a call, or he'd be intentional about giving me a call. But, you know, ever since kids have really come into the picture, you know, you just kind of lose touch. And so here's my best man saying that he wants to see me sometime in the next year. And what's going on in my head is surprise. Oh, man, he reached out to me. You know, this guy was my best friend for years and years and years. You know, if you're not intentional, these things, they drift apart. You know, same thing, another one of my groomsmen, a month ago, I see that he endorsed me for 9 skills on LinkedIn. I was like, whoa, where did that come from? And so I went to his LinkedIn page, and I don't endorse somebody unless I've seen them actually do something. And so I'm staring at all these skills that Chad supposedly has, and I'm like, I don't know if he has these skills because I haven't seen him in 15 years. How sad is that? But if we're not intentional, then these friendships are going to fall away. So we've got to take time. We've got to be intentional to build these strong friendships. And we need to go deeper. It can't be just, hey, I really like the Colts and, you know, that Andrew Luck, you think he's going to survive the season. It's got to go deeper than that. You know, we got to talk about our thoughts and our feelings and what's going on in our life. And when we open up, that gives the other person permission to open up as well. And that's going to help create these deep bonds, these partnership type bonds that God has given into our life so that we can survive a broken world. And ultimately, we need to remember that the truest friend any of us will ever have is Jesus, and that he is always there for us. So let's pray. Dear Lord, again, we thank you for this wonderful passage of Scripture, a very famous passage of Scripture, Lord, but it is true that you created us to have some people in our life that correspond to us. We thank you for spouses, Lord, especially, that we can live life with. Lord, we thank you for children and parents and siblings and good, solid friends, too, that are there for us when we need them, Lord. And so we just pray that we can keep cultivating these friendships, that we can make them deeper, and that we can center them around you, and remember that you are the ultimate friend, that you are always there for us whenever we need you. We pray this in your wonderful name. Amen. All right, turn with me to hymn number 630, What a Friend We Have in Jesus, as we close up.